Welcome to A Book I Love. And next to me, Helen Thomas, the co-founder of Women Writing Architecture and A Book I Love, this format that we're speaking in today. Emily Appercy, the second co-founder of Women Writing Architecture and A Book I Love. Charlotte Mata, art historian and currently holding the assistant professorship of the Laurens Professur of Contemporary Art at the University in Basel. And Jae-hee Shin, architect, who is running an independent architecture and writing practice based in Zurich and Graubünden. I am Geraldine Tedder. I'm currently the director of Kunsthalle Winterthur. I formerly worked at GTA Exhibitions, which is why I popped up on this podcast a lot in the past. Together, we are sitting at Spitzplatz, a small park next to Zurich Main Station. The triangular park is surrounded by water on two sides. This Spitz, or point, is formed by the joining of the Limmat and the Sihl rivers. This coming together of routes, rail, water and road that ultimately stretch across Europe in a park famous for its open drug scene in the 80s perhaps makes this an apt place to meet today. Today we are discussing Ice by Annika Van, which was published in 1967. Chosen by Emily, I believe, because she was interested in the book after it was mentioned as an important reference for the dominatrix and artist Reba Mabry. Annika Van is a pseudonym, a fictional character taken from her own work, adopted by a female British writer. She was also a painter and heroin addict who lived in different countries throughout her life, at first with her parents and then with her two consecutive husbands. Much of her writing evokes weird mindscapes and explores themes of captivity, mental illness and being a patient, vulnerable, weak and infantilized, all of which she experienced in her own life. Ice is haunting. It plays in an apocalyptic world encroached by ice. The narrator or narrators are male who is or who are obsessed with a fragile, unnamed woman often called the girl. The narrator's pursuit of the girl is aggressive and controlling. The girl is often portrayed as a helpless victim. It is hard for the reader to tell apart delusion of the narrator from the reality of the story. This fictional text is usually called a novel, but this seems to be the wrong word to label it with. Read on those terms, it is difficult to engage with. Narrative and character development are not important, nor are relatable emotions, environments, or psychological states. Nor is it a non-fictional text. There are no facts, thesis, or commentaries. The reader is left quite alone to define the book for themselves. Many readers report encountering an entirely different book when they read it again. Sometimes the term slipstream is used to define Ice, describing it as a text that melds together surrealist or not quite realistic qualities with apocalyptic science fiction and fantasy. So I'm curious to discuss how this very open and fluid, but at the same time claustrophobic, emotionless, but provoking text can become architectural. Would you like to start, Emily, why you chose this book?
Yes, thank you for the introduction. So didn't read the book before choosing it. So maybe we can discuss if I really loved it or not, or if you loved it. A Book I Love is most of the time we ask people to choose a companion books that have been following you during your life that you cherish. I don't think I have this kind of book. One that came to my mind was 1001 Nights, this kind of book that you have, you read it when you are six, you fully understand it, you learn a lot from it, and you read it again maybe years later and you fully understand it in another way. And but I liked a lot in that book the kind of alternate world it was describing. There are also time manipulation, like magical technologies also. And I like how speculative and how it describes familiar things, but also weird things. And so when choosing, you mentioned Reba Mabry. I came across Ice through an annotation she did for an exhibition called Faster Than an Erection. She's the expert of stretching with power dynamics between male and female and through language, communication, and sexuality. And I mean, at Women Writing Architecture, it's definitely a theme that we always have in our discussion. And I also came across Ice from an interview from Dominique Gonzalez-Foster, who is a French artist that works a lot with installation. And she rebuilds climates or like spaces that have to do a lot with emotional states linked to characters. And I was really intrigued. I know she reads a lot, and I'm very intrigued by people or practices that link literature to architecture. So that's why I thought I would love this book, and they were speaking highly about it. So I thought, okay, let's go reading it. But I know it was very annoying to read, as the plan structure of the book is so unstable. And basically, you constantly wonder if you missed the old parts of the chapter. So I don't know how it was for you, but I had to reread sometimes two or three times the chapter because I was thinking I was becoming crazy. But I make a lot of connection to architecture, and maybe I give an example of a passage to explain the way she makes the climate. So she's describing a world, a climate that you can't escape, that sometimes opens you to new horizons and sometimes also close you up, as the way you described in the introduction, like a landscape emotions. And there is one moment, for instance, where she says snowflakes are blurring your perception to your environment, and how the walls of the buildings becomes eyes, how the climate becomes forms, and how the light goes through the eyes. In the climate becomes a surface, like an architectural surface somehow. And I really love the way, maybe it has to do a lot with science fiction, but the way she found to describe a complexity that is contained in the architecture, but that architecture itself doesn't really express. These things that when you walk in the city, or not just in the city, you sometimes have this sensation of being familiar to things, but at another moment it's completely hostile, or how your environment completely transform and metamorphose. I think that's one thing that really came. And I can give also a concrete example to my own life in Zurich. I live where there are a lot of drug addicts that also cohabitate, but there is also children, schools, and all those different communities are never crossing in a way. But you hear, because crack addicts, they completely get mad when they are missing. So you hear weird voices. So you have traces of like different people living in the same place. So like, and you just see like things have been displaced. And it resonates a lot with the book in a way. But I'm really curious to hear, yeah, if you make connections to architecture as well, or your own.
Yeah, for me it was that the general whole impression that when I read this novel, and that the woman are never given her name, and as Sherry commented from the beginning, and then she's simply referred to as a girl, and then she was described as like chased and made to disappear by men and locked up, but her emotion and voice are never really present. And I raised the question why industry only told from male voices and male perspective. And I just started to question, and interestingly, architecture, or out of architecture generally in the world, is not much different, surprisingly. Just architecture canon in history generally have been written by male figure for a long time. And just like this novel, maybe it was like this fact has been hidden and there were no women's voices and names. But the next question was, is only for like relate to women and male voices, because this pressure and controlling in the system, in the society, is not only those kind of problem, maybe it's also architectures relate to capitalism. And even though we don't really want to connect it in this way, and we want to find an alternative way, but this competing the world and the way of working also in the life, it somehow, so in the end, was so difficult feeling. And so
Jae-hee, when you were talking earlier, you said that you'd read the book in Korean and in English, and that the emotion was different in both versions. I'm really fascinated what you mean by that.
Yeah, in Korean version, translation is always more calm. And the English version, originally, the Anna Kevin writing, I always have to come back the fact that male perspective is actually a voice, but I have always feeling it's actually like a female perspective with like a male mask. I always repeatedly remember, but in Korean translation, I had less those kind of feeling because it's more like fine, so refined, and it's not really too directly emotional. Yeah, there are only one translation, so it was a bit less emotional and less pressure. And
did you like the book? Did someone love the book?
I mean, I didn't love the book, but no, I kind of did love the book, actually, I have to say. I mean, it was like, I thought it was really mad, like really, but in a good way, like really invigorating mad. Like, then, and of course, these like power dynamics are just so depressing, but I mean, I thought that was so good that they were so depressing. Like, that was like how this male narrator is portrayed. For me, it was quite clear because I guess there are different ways you can read this male narrator. If when these two characters, and I really kind of quite clearly read it as like a schizophrenic male character who was maybe both these characters, like the warden and the narrator at the same time, and how fluidly those like change one between the other. And just how extreme like that portrayal of that control mechanism is for the male over this like non-existent female. And it's just clearly like all projection and all delusion somehow of this male narrator. I mean, I thought that was brilliant, actually. I really liked it, although it was also really depressing.
Yeah, I think this control mechanism that you were describing is also, was for me the interesting link to architecture, because the whole book feels so claustrophobic. And there's this relation to space that is always getting tighter and smaller and more constrictive throughout the book. So there's really this idea of being held captive, the prison as this metaphor for this feeling of being captive and not in control of your own body. And then tied up with these very male, yet this notion of male domination that gets entangled with human domination over nature, right? So there's this parallelity between the collapse of the environment and the world and the collapse of the idea maybe of control and male supremacy that is quite interesting, I thought.
I didn't love it. I mean, I think it's interesting Jehi was talking about emotions, because for me it was quite emotional. I mean, I provoked quite strong emotions of kind of disgust and anger, and I really hated the way the girl was described. That was quite interesting to deal with, I think, that you're saying, Jerry. But I found myself really casting around trying to engage with it on an intellectual level because of that. So there's no way that you could identify with any of the characters in the book. So there's no, you weren't emotionally within that world at all. And the world was just terrifying. And as you say, extremely claustrophobic, all those cabins and cars. And it was, and I think that it contributed to it, you know. So you're feeling you're being forced into these ever decreasing spaces, and you feel like fighting. So I thought that was really interesting, that there's this emotional confrontation. Kind of hated it sometimes and really disliked it, but it was provoking, which I think is a really valuable thing for a book. But I was also thinking about this representation of reality, because early on in Women Writing Architecture, we looked at the poet Lynn Hejinian and her long poem My Life, where she uses parataxis, which is where each sentence is disconnected from the one before. And I did quickly revisit the book just before our conversation. And when you're saying, when you both, Emily and Jerry, talked about the discontinuity of the narrative, that, and I went and I looked, and she does it. It's very, very explicit, although because you're not expecting it, you kind of think it's a continuity, or you hope it's a continuity. But when you go back to it, you realise that it completely changes tenses and who's being talked about and what the environment is. Just quickly, an immediate switch with no gap. Usually there's a paragraph break, but it's almost like reality isn't being presented as one line. It keeps reversing on itself or being something completely different. So, which in a way, I think what Lynn Hejinian was trying to do with My Life was show that there's a constellation of ideas and images, and I think images are very important to her, that come together to make an idea of reality which isn't homogeneous. A homogeneous idea, it's something that you have to have in different pictures in your head and put together.
That's a really nice idea. I was rereading some passage in English, I read the biography of Anna Kavan in between, and I'm not an expert of who she was. I know she was also a drug addict, but I couldn't get away from reading the text from her perspective, because I thought this must have been feelings of insecurity, of she was probably helpless, or I don't know, like, I don't understand. Maybe there is something to think about the fact that she decided to be in the character of a male, but it was completely shifting the way I started even understand defense strategy towards situation where you can't escape. There is this one scene where I think it's a kind of rape scene with many women, and she's one of them, and she knows what's going to happen. Somehow, the way she escaped from it is to completely detach herself and dream. And it's also very provocative. And you think maybe the only place you can find refuge is when you go really deep into your intimate space. And I found this detachment to reality also quite interesting, and maybe even evoking this text that everybody was reading in the last years, Staying with the Trouble by Donna Haraway. In other part of the text, you have description of an environment where you see that the inhabitants accept that it's really bad, and they don't make any effort to come back to normal. They don't make any renovation and things like that. And it made me make this connection with Staying with the Trouble, which I think for the creative field has been influential for architect, this idea that you have this environment, we have a lot of mediocre architecture we have to deal with because it's there, and you have to find strategy, or you have to start composing with what is there. And I think also in fashion, Marine Serre, for instance, she has done this collection where she says, okay, nowadays we live with pollution in the city, so let's make a mask to breathe better. So this idea that you accept your condition and you know that you're not going to escape, and that everything is so unstable. And
yeah, I mean, hearing you talk, and also I was thinking of what you were saying before, Charlotte, also this term of collapse, actually, which was a term I was thinking about, and maybe is even a little bit more extreme than what you're saying, really staying with the trouble, but really also letting this collapse happen and not trying to repair it. And I'm also like, I'm making the connection to Halberstam, which I guess you know very well. Maybe you can say something, because I really had to think about also Halberstam and this term of collapse in connection to architecture and this novel, and how present that is in the novel.
Yeah, I think it's something really different, though, that is being somehow articulated in the novel by Anna Kavan. I'm not sure, or maybe you can tell me if you were thinking of a specific connection, but yeah, it's really this provocation, right? I think that's why it's difficult to say that we love this book, because it's really thinking this collapse through to the bitter end. We were also talking previously about the fact that there's no redemption at the end. There's no closure. It's like I was waiting for it the whole time. But also knowing that it was a tip from Reba Maybury, somehow I was expecting the power dynamics to be switching at the end, and somehow I was expecting this voiceless girl to take power, to take things into her hands, to gain a voice that she hasn't throughout the whole book. But then there's no such thing. So it's really this collapse it's the ultimate radical collapse that's where there's nothing that can start anew from it. It's not like a productive thing, as I understand it, in the writing of Halberstam, that you can really think with collapse, along with collapse. But it's really just, it's so dark. Yeah. But I also wanted to go back with what you, Helen and Emily, you were talking about, this notion of perception. And this, I think, is really interesting also in connection with Jai, what you were saying about the notion of emotions, because I was feeling like this notion of the eyes was really doing something also on maybe even a kind of bodily experience of trying to imagine this cold. Also the sound quality that we all know when there's like, when everything is covered by snow, there's a different acoustic quality to the spaces that we walk through. Perception is really heightened also, right? In environments that are covered with snow or covered with ice. And then there's also this recurring motif of being, I think you said previously, Emily, yeah, blurring perception. There's also a part where she's writing, or the narrator is writing about the notion of blindness, this whole light of the white snow. And so I don't know if there's also a link, you are also referring to her biography, if there is also here a link to the experience of drugs, of the hallucinatory experience of drugs.
I mean, it's interesting you come to the, when you said ice, I thought you were saying eyes, and then you came to eyes, because when I was looking around trying to make sense of the book and my strong emotions, I looked, there was a very interesting article about her being a painter, and the argument was very much about the images that she makes, which are really powerful. I mean, like, especially the towering cliffs of ice closing in. But she made a painting, I'm not sure whether it was a self-portrait, but it was a woman and her eyes were complete, just blue. And it's so, you, I don't know, I just think why, it was fairly Mondigliani-ish otherwise, but with blue eyes. For me, when there's a blank surface in a mirror or eyes, or, it always feels like you nothing inside, that it's like a purgatory or a gusting wind or a, something absent. But not a quiet absent like you feel with the snow, but something very, very troubled. So I don't know. I guess in a way I connected it to this idea of, I mean, what you were talking about withdrawal, Emily, I think, that she withdrew from terrible experiences. So, yeah, I don't know. I wonder if that's a significant thing, that in her painting, that was a motif.
I really didn't dive into her biography. I don't know, but I also didn't take so much drugs in my life to make the connection. But for sure, there's, I mean, resignation, this distance making, it would have been interesting to speak with a psychologist or someone like that about the book. But I was wondering, because I've read the text partly in French, partly in English, I was wondering about what did you think of the way she writes, because I know, Helen, you have certain author you really hate how they write, and sometimes you like it. I wonder if you find some kind of invention there or not at all. I think in English the rhythmus of the language is very important, and you have much more, I think, adjectives to describe things.
What do I think for writing? Well, adjectives aren't necessarily a good thing in English.
Yeah.
It's kind of a sign of not good
writing. Position, right? Or like
Well, relying on descriptive words requires other artfulness to convey it. Mm. I didn't find her writing amazing, but I did find it very much, the images very powerful. And I also kind of found the jaggedness of it quite interesting as well. It wasn't smooth and perfect at all. It is kind of like a jagged knife, or I don't know. That's kind of interesting. I'm thinking hairy, but it's not hairy. It's kind of jagged. But I was complaining away. Oh yeah, but you know, J.G. Ballard, he's such an amazing writer. Like, he can write something much, much shorter, and the desolation is so much more powerful in his book. This requires, but you know, that's the way she writes. And so the very powerful images and the claustrophobia, which, I mean, you could say crude, but they're very powerfully put forward. I don't know, they all contribute to, actually, you know, the emotions I felt from reading her book were much more powerful than reading a J.G. Ballard. J.G. Ballard, you can just like breathe through it and, oh yeah, that's really interesting, and you can reflect upon it. But this, it's a different experience, and that is a powerful thing, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was almost, I think jaggedness is a nice word, actually, because it's almost this like in between. I felt like when I was reading it, I had these strong images, and at the same time, they weren't strong at all. I was kind of seeing these architectures popping up somehow, but they weren't fully taking shape because it was switching all the time, and it was like kind of morphing all the time, these images in my head. And like you said, you know, I had to reread chapters and like, oh, what's actually happening? And that's not an easy thing to do. Like, I also thought like the language itself wasn't amazing, but creating those types of images that somehow are like in between, that's, I thought that was quite impressive.
I have another totally different question, but I'm just wondering if you had similar thoughts. But at the beginning of the second chapter, so rather at the beginning of the book, there's a phrase where the figure of the girl is described as free, white, and 21. And this really struck me also because of the very well-known work of Haradina Pindell, which is titled Free, White, and 21, which is, of course, later. It's from 1980. But where she really talks about her experience of racism within the art world and the feminist movement. And so I looked it up. It's really a phrase that seems to have been in use, like in movies from the 1930s and 40s already, where it was actually used by white people to actually claim their privileges. And so and because this was really fairly at the beginning of the book, and this figure of the girl is this porcelain white figure that has this hair that is almost white also. It's all about whiteness, right? There's also obviously the motif of the ice and the snow. And then there's also all these instances of civil unrest. And of course, she's writing this in 1967, so in the 1960s. I'm not sure where she was exactly based when she wrote the book, but she was certainly aware of the civil rights movement in the USA. There was also in the UK an anti-racist political movement forming. So I don't know enough about her to know if there is some kind of, I don't know, engagement with questions of race and racism at the time. But I was just wondering if that somehow resonates with you.
I think that's a brilliant observation. Yeah. I hadn't thought of it in that way, but I think, yeah, it's really... Because she did live in different countries. I can't remember now where she lived. But she must have encountered that relationship. So the power, this imbalance of power and this abuse of power isn't just gendered. She is creating anger. It's almost like a manifesto. And that's really, really something interesting.
I think it's a really nice conclusion.
If anyone wants to say anything, it was really nice to talk again.